Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. The mission of the Socially Relevant Film Festival is to shine a spotlight on filmmakers who tell compelling, socially relevant human interest stories across a broad range of social issues without resorting to gratuitous violence or violent forms of filmmaking. Since its inception in 2013, the festival has presented some 300 films from 35 countries. This year's runs from Friday, March 15th to Thursday the 21st at Cinema Village and other venues. I'm very pleased it has brought its founding artistic director, Nora Armani, to our show now. And we are also joined by 2 of the filmmakers included in this year's lineup, Katie McLean, director of Seeing is Believing, Women Direct, and M.A. Taylor, director of The Creepy Line. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Nora, thanks for having me.
Nora, with so many film festivals already out there, what inspired you to start another one in 2013?
That's a great question. Also, let me just backtrack a little bit. I had been curating and guest curating a bunch of other film festivals, not necessarily starting one from scratch, but I knew what it took, and I felt, no, I can never start a film festival. And then cut to, suddenly I am in the middle of organizing one. It came as a necessity to offer an alternative form of entertainment. First of all, because...
To fill a vacuum in a way?
I'm sorry?
Did you feel you were filling a vacuum? There was a need to fill a vacuum?
Maybe not necessarily a vacuum, because these films exist. But in a way, maybe I was trying to put them together in one program, let's say, and make them available to the audience that chooses to see this type of film. I got a little turned off, to say the least, by all the violence that we see on movie posters. It's very rare to see a movie poster nowadays of one of these big Hollywood movies that doesn't have a gun on it. And really, I mean, if you don't want to see a violent movie, you can choose not to go to see it. But if it's a poster and it's right there on the bus stop, on everywhere staring at you, it's very difficult to avoid it.
Katie, is your film Seeing is Believing, Women Direct, your first documentary feature?
Yes, it is.
And I'm assuming that you felt you had to make it because it's a subject that gets way too little attention.
Yes. I mean, I've been an actor my entire life, since I was a child, and I saw so few women directors, it never even occurred to me. In my early 20s, I started studying directing, and I fell in love with it, and then I had my mother and other people just strongly discourage me, saying this was not a career that women could succeed at. So
she said that after you turned 40, nobody in Hollywood would want to cast you in a movie, although... There are Glenn Close, Rachel Weisz, Meryl Streep, Julianne Moore, a few others. But they were already big stars.
That's true, but that's another thing that's changing radically, which is really wonderful to see the women who are older now getting embraced for their ability and their experience. And, you know, new actresses coming up who are coming onto the field. And I think this crosses lines in terms of all professions. I'm seeing so many women who maybe have been mothers coming back into the workforce and feeling that there is more space for them. And this film has been a part of that movement where women are saying, listen, you know, we still have something to say. We have something to contribute. We have stories to tell, and these stories have value. So when I was in my 40s and I started directing and I started hearing these statistics, I felt that I had a responsibility to be a part of the solution and to be a part of this change in order to make this space for both myself and for the many women I knew who really had amazing gifts and abilities that deserved a spotlight.
M.A., Matthew, I'm going to call you Matthew, How did you get into directing?
Well, I actually came out of art school, and I did a number of variety of art projects, and I got into video art and things like that. And then I did some work for the Discovery Channel, and I kind of loved being able to merge a commercial skill set with an artistic skill set and be able to explore topics that interested me that were either socially important, artistically important. Sometimes the two crossed over. We have The Creepy Line, and then we have actually a film about an artist coming out in 2 months. So it's a very exciting kind of thing that you can do. It has a lot of impact. It reaches a lot of people. Documentaries are now more available to people now that are streaming services, so you don't have to just see them in New York or L.A. anymore. You can see them everywhere. And I think the entire documentary industry is having this beautiful rebirth, and I think it's exciting for all of the people who make documentaries to be able to get their voice out there now.
And your film feels quite timely. The Creepy Line is about the effect that Google, Facebook, and other social media have had on our lives. Are most people unaware of how much their decisions are influenced by these social media companies?
Absolutely. I think the unfortunate situation is that almost everybody's unaware of how much they tinker with even the most minute parts of our life, whether it's via our smartphones, whether it's the products we buy, whether it's our opinion. Eric Schmidt, I believe a couple of years ago, said that their Google's intention for the next 10 years is to determine what we believe. And he used that term specifically. And of course, The Creepy Line gets its title from Google's policy, which Eric Schmidt said in 2010 is Google's policy is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it. And we found that it's a very odd word to use.
Did they define what the creepy line was?
We believe they move the creepy line every day according to what their goals are.
Uh-huh.
And so if we don't start evaluating what these companies are really up to, we believe that they're totalitarian in nature.
Now, Nora, what's your selection process for this festival? What makes a film socially relevant?
Yes, it's like, first of all, because of this violent issue, I wanted to limit it to films that don't deal with violence. And then I realized that's kind of limiting it. So because I have a sociology background, besides being an actress and producer and filmmaker and all that, I thought it would be good to open it up to all sorts of social issues. The way it happens is where we have our submission platforms, and filmmakers from all over the world submit their films. We have a selection committee who sits down and watches these films, because there's no way I can sit and watch 500 films by myself.
And then to some degree, your taste may not be
the determining factor, exactly.
Something that might be less interesting to you than it would be to an awful lot of
totally,
other people.
Totally, totally. I like to listen, and it's a cross-section of different kinds of people from all sorts of walks of life. And then we do first an elimination process. Things that aren't good in terms of production values immediately are eliminated, even if they're talking about the most pressing and most important social issue. Then the social issue is determined. Then we go yes, no, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, all the no's are taken out. And then the yeses somehow tell us their own story. And that's how the program takes shape.
So it's a wide range of things: racism, sexism, homelessness, immigration, mm-hmm. environmental issues, etc. Do you have some kind of a sense of an overall theme for each festival, or is it just let's try to cover as wide a range of topics as possible?
Well, it's neither nor. It's not we don't set up to say, oh, we don't have anything about this topic, let's go find something. No. Or we don't say this year's topic is this. We let the films that have sort of floated to the surface determine what the topics of that particular year are going to be.
A mix of narrative films and documentaries,
yeah,
and feature-length films and shorts.
Yeah. The shorts are very, very interesting because the way we group the shorts, those are the most theme-oriented ones. We put the bunch of shorts, groups of shorts, into thematic elements. Like, for example, we have pollution and environment. We have capital punishment. We have women and women issues. We have immigration and refugees. Last year we had age issues, ageism and aging. This year we also have across the border films that are about Mexican situations and also crossing the border, immigration, and all the films that are shorts and kind of talk about the same topic are grouped together in those themes.
Are most of them being seen in New York for the first time?
Yes, that's a good question, because we insist that the films that we show are at least New York City premieres.
Mm-hmm. Although they come from all over the world, don't they?
Yes, they do. We have a bunch of world premieres as well in this year's program.
How many countries are represented?
This year we have 30 countries that are represented.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't think that people in other countries are making films about the problems at the U.S. border.
Not necessarily, no. I mean, these are the shorts that are in that group. But we have films, for example, about the LGBT movement in Holland. Mm-hmm. And it's called Monument of Pride. And it's a fantastic piece about does the historic thing. And it's on the Stonewall riots, 50th anniversary. So it's very, very pertinent this year. Then we have another one which is about female genital mutilation, which is called In the Name of Your Daughter. It's about Tanzania and all that. It's a Canadian film, but shot in all these countries that practice this terrible practice. And it's a wide range. It's true that some of the films deal with local issues, U.S.-oriented issues, but a lot of them deal with issues that are international but also touch us.
Katie, in your film, Seeing is Believing, Women Direct, include clips of interviews where you ask people to name a woman director, and most of them can't think of any, even though there have been some pretty prominent ones over the years.
I know. It's really amazing. And it's a wide range of people, even a few women who can't think of the name of a woman director. And that really speaks to how the press has responded to films directed by women. They've been sort of categorized in this sort of female genre, or only like Nancy Meyers film talking about it's a romance, or, you know, really minimized in a way into something that seems very old fashioned instead of thinking about the mind of the person that has created this film and celebrating that mind. And that's something that I'm trying to inspire in the press, is to talk about women as visionaries. Whether they're filmmakers or people like Nora, who have created this incredible festival out of her own, you know, inspiration and ideas, you know, uplifting these women and celebrating them is in the press, like you're doing with this wonderful interview, is something that really needs to happen more, I think.
Well, tomorrow is International Women's Day, so people are starting to catch on to the problem.
That's right. Yeah. Actually, speaking of which, one of our spotlight events is a film which is called The Man Who Mends Women, about the 2018 Nobel Peace Prize winning Dr. Denis Mukwege, who is a Congolese doctor who helps all these women who have been sexually violated and abused and raped during the 20-year Congo conflict. And we're having a fantastic panel discussion following the film immediately, a panel of women who are going to be talking about women and children in conflict zones. And we have Pramila Patton, who is the UN Undersecretary General responsible for sexual violence in conflict, and CSW Chair Susan O'Malley, and other distinguished ladies.
Is it your sense, Katie, that most of the women who go into directing did begin as actors? I mean, we have Ida Lupino, I guess, is the first really prominent one, although there were other women directors before her. More recently, Jodie Foster, Angelina Jolie. Is it because they feel that their careers have been stalled, or simply because these are intelligent people who, like Paul Newman, think, well, I also want to direct a film?
It's funny. That's kind of there's a two-pronged answer to that. Mm-hmm. The first part is there are many, many women who did not come out of acting who directed. In fact, one of the first women directors that we know of is Alice Guy Blaché, and there's a wonderful documentary called Be Natural going around talking about, you know, her additions to the filmmaking world. We know about the female directors who are were formerly actors because they already walk into the conversation with a certain amount of fame. In my experience in talking to actors who became directors, it's because they love the medium and they want to expand their conversation with the medium and with the team-making experience of film. And that's really what they want to do. They want to participate in the conversation and tell their stories, because sometimes acting is somewhat limited. You know, you are a piece of the puzzle rather than, you know, the mind and the vision that is creating the puzzle.
We're speaking about the Socially Relevant Film Festival, which begins on Friday the 15th and runs through Thursday the 21st at Cinema Village. And I said in other venues, it's going to be another
thing? Actually, all the films screen at Cinema Village. The other venues are more like for the networking events and also for workshops and panels.
And if listeners are patient, we'll be talking about how you might be able to, you as WNYC listeners might be able to get passes to all of these events. There's a lot more that I want to talk about women in filmmaking, Katie, but I want to get Matthew into this conversation.
Please.
As well. And we'll come back to you. So, Matthew, you said that the creepy line comes from the former Google CEO Eric Schmidt's statement, the Google policy on a lot of things is to get right up to the creepy line and not cross it. Now, how much can be known about us? Can they know about us and influence our decisions?
I would say they know more about you than you know about you. Because just the basic, if you think about it, they have 200 or over 200 different platforms. But the one platform we use more than anything, and the one platform where there's no alternative, is the actual Google search. And the Google search is the most powerful manipulation platform they have. It is the platform in which you input all of the questions you have that you wouldn't ask a spouse, friend, anybody, your priest, nobody. Hmm. And so every time you use that search, and every time you're in a location, and every time you're around something, they are able to detect that, and it is added to your profile. This is how they sell your data, or they use your data with advertisers so that they can target advertising back at you. And so the actual search itself, that little bar that we type all of our information into, ends up becoming one of their most powerful manipulation tools in just its operation. And so, you know, Sundar Pichai may sit in front of Congress and say there is no bias, but that is simply not true, because the search engine, by design, must be biased in order to give you results. Just to give you a quick example, if I search for what's the best dog food, that search engine must make two decisions that are critical to how it manipulates you. Number one, it must choose from billions of pages. And number two, it must put them in an order. And that order can shift your opinion based on a series of studies by Dr. Robert Epstein out of San Diego to one thing or another. And this is rote conditioning that you use this list constantly to think that things at the top are always true. So if Google changes their algorithm, which they do twice a day by their own admission, they can put anything in any order to shift your opinion toward anything they deem fit.
Don't they claim that it's based on how popular a site is? So the ones that get the most hits are the ones that are on top? Is that not true?
No, that is not true.
Do people who run the Google have the ability to skew the results?
Well, absolutely. I mean, again, if they are modifying the algorithm twice daily, again, according to their own admission, and they have to give you better results, the question is, what is better? Because it is not an algorithm that chooses by popularity. It is called a backrub algorithm, and it's a complex kind of, we break it down in the film with a series of graphics. It's harder to explain, but it basically looks at the relationship of links between pages and gives you results that way. So it's not particularly the most popular page, but it's the most relevant page. And how do you determine what's relevant? And so that's where the algorithm is touched by human hands. So your ethics are encoded into the machine. And so if your ethics are, I like Abraham Lincoln rather than George Washington, you may skew, not even knowing it as the programmer, towards George Washington or towards Abraham Lincoln or towards this dog food or that dog food. Mm. And so every single time you use that search engine, those two biases are kicking in. And whatever goes to the top, and you have no way to tell why it went there or if it's really the best thing. Because remember, most of the time you're looking for facts. What's the capital of Kansas? Topeka. But if you ask it something that's not a fact, like, you know, where do I go for dinner? That algorithm has to make that decision for you, and that shifts you.
Right.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Now, I realize now I don't have to go to Google to find out the capital of Kansas. I just have to call you. Most people think of Google as a neutral search engine. Is that part of what makes it so powerful?
It is, because the thing about it is that the neutrality because here's the thing, Google does censor. Google censors lots of things, but this violates a law called CDA 230, the Common Decency Act, which states that a platform is not responsible for its users as long as it doesn't edit its users. This is a thing that Facebook as well violates on a daily basis, and they censor all sorts of things. And there's no one to call. You don't know why you're being censored. And we cover this pretty extensively in the film about how when they linked all your accounts together, your YouTube account, your Gmail account, your calendar account, if you get censored on one, you get censored on all. So if your business relies on these tools and Google, for some reason, decides they don't like you or they push you down in the rankings, that can destroy your business. And there's literally nothing you can do about it.
In your film, Dr. Robert Epstein says Google crosses the creepy line every day.
Yes.
So
absolutely.
So if I'm looking for something, the tendency is for me to just stick on the first page, rarely go to the second page or third page. I might find stuff that is really more relevant if I just keep on going through the pages.
Well, most likely you will find things, because here's how it works. You can, there are pages that do not track you, but they will not give you personal results. Because part of the reason, because here's the thing, I'm not saying these products don't work. They work exceptionally well. You get exactly what they think you need based on all of your activity that's been accumulated over how many years have we been using Google. And so in a lot of ways, it's more dangerous for businesses that get moved to the second page or the third page. You know, there was a lawsuit, of course, in the EU where Google was fined $5.7 billion for this kind of manipulation, because in the EU they have very different standards. In fact, we were just over in Germany presenting the film to the German parliament and members of the EU to discuss some of what their measures are. And they have a very different standard of measures than the United States. They care about IP over free speech. We care about free speech over IP. And so that's why we have fair use laws here. They don't have them there. So it's a complicated scenario in how you see things, and that the fact that businesses and really anybody who wants to promote anything is at the mercy of these companies pushing you up and down the rankings or eliminating you altogether.
And we've all had the experience of looking up something online, perhaps reading a review of a play or a film or searching for a present for someone, and then having ads for it pop up everywhere we go online for days after. How does that work?
Well, again, it's an abstract. It's kind of the story of the gentleman who started receiving flyers about babies because his daughter was pregnant and he didn't know, right? And so this is a story that happens all the time. We give them the information. I mean, this is kind of the dark side of it, is that while we think they're doing a lot of bad things, we did opt in, right? So we have a responsibility for handing over all this information in the first place.
We all
signed up for
Go ahead.
Sorry, go on.
No, keep on going.
We all signed up for Gmail. We used Google Maps. We bought the Android phone. These are surveillance platforms. And we signed in, and it made our lives easier, but it made our lives controllable by what is one of the most insidious companies in the entire world, because we just don't know what they're doing. There's no transparency.
But what about, is Facebook just as culpable as Google or Twitter or Instagram? There's been a lot of talk about how the political process has been influenced by the social media?
Oh, Facebook is another extremely horrible company. To give you an example, there is Facebook had an idea that they would identify depressed teenagers and show them stories to see what they would do, negative stories, right? And some of these teenagers caused harm to themselves. This was an experiment, right? And so, and this is 2017. This isn't like a long time ago. They got caught, right? And so any company that treats their customers like cattle, it's unethical, it's immoral. And the thing is that Facebook in some ways is more insidious because they have a more cruel mandate, whereas Google is more utopian. And so they view things as eliminating things they see as wrong. And so it's a different kind of mandate. Also, Facebook, we don't have to use it. Google, we don't have a choice. There's no alternative to Google search. And so we are these companies, you know, of course, Facebook owns Instagram. They own WhatsApp. They are trying to put messages into these various platforms. They're trying to put advertising. So they are consolidating our communication. They're consolidating our emails. They're consolidating what we do every day into this monolith to basically control what we do, you know, every day.
Doesn't Facebook keep track of everything that we post and who we're friends with? What would they do with all of that data? And especially since there's the data breach from last year was headline news. I don't know what that really means to me. Is there somebody out there who now knows stuff about me that I wouldn't want them to know?
Well, absolutely. And I think the bigger issue is while Facebook and Google are kind of the evil overlords, the other issue is a lot of smaller companies are starting to pick up on their business model. And their business model is to collect your data and use it against you. So some of the most insidious apps are weather apps, because you check the weather every day and it gives your location and it tells, you know, where you are and what you're doing and what you're near or you're near the store. And so other companies are starting to mimic these larger companies. And most of the apps on your phone are starting to track you. And here's the thing. I mean, we know that in the upcoming election, you know, these massive pipes of data will be picked up by both parties and used to do advertising and all sorts of other things to convince people. And I don't think it's – I mean, we had this whole idea of fake news. But fake news, you can see. What these companies are doing, it's completely invisible. You don't even know it's happening.
Are there ways to protect ourselves?
Unfortunately,
other than just not use search engines or social media sites?
I mean, this is the unfortunate part. We have moved into a point where there's some tools we cannot divorce ourselves from. You cannot use Facebook. That is true. And you can switch to another email. But look at it this way. Apple Mail sits on Google servers, right? New York Times sits on Google servers. That means when New York Times is investigating Google, Google's reading the emails that pass through New York Times. You know, and so there's going to have to be a serious – all the legislation we have is 20th century for 20th century companies. We have to literally rethink our regulatory tools and make them 21st century for these new 21st century companies.
Katie, I want to get back to you, but we're going to be taking a little – maybe we'll take the break right now, and then we'll talk more about women – making films and whether they make films differently than men do. This is Leonard Lopate at Large. Let's talk a bit more about women making films. Katie, you have a quote from Miranera who says, if we don't tell our own stories, no one will. Do you think that women and men approach storytelling in different ways?
You know, I think the question itself sort of has to be taken apart a little bit, because there is an assumption that men even tell stories in a particular way, or maybe drawn to violent stories or hero type of journeys, where there is a wide range of abilities and interests and sensitivities in both genders or in any gender identification. And so that's something that I find very inspiring about talking to people after the film who have been men or young men, because they start to see that what the problem is an idea. that idea that we are different. We are different in our inspirations, in the stories that we want to tell, in how we tell those stories. But ultimately, we are all human, and an artist is an artist. And so what I'm trying to refocus that question toward is why have we felt that because this story or this idea is coming out of someone who is walking around in a female body at the moment, why are we thinking that that person's story is so particularly different, the way they're going to tell it, than a person who walks around in a man's body? And certainly that female experience can be unique because of what you're exposed to culturally, but that's also different from culture to culture and different from family to family. There's just such a massive range of what is coming out of these people who are in these female bodies.
But we have seen this in the area of novels, where some of the best male characters have been written by female novelists, and vice versa. There's some people who feel that you can't write about another race, even though some incredible writing has been done by people of a different race. So in the end, isn't this really all about just telling stories about humans? But do you think that women are less likely to... Well, we've had some war films and films with explosions directed women. By women as well. So
certainly, Catherine Bigelow is the first female to win an Oscar for a narrative feature. There's been many who've won for a documentary film, for The Hurt Locker, and that, of course, was what is considered classically a male narrative, a violent war film. And people project their ideas of her sensitivity, her female, quote-unquote, you know, emotional side or whatever that she may have brought to the film. But she is admittedly fascinated with male violence. Like, that's the thing, that's the story that she wants to tell. And so I think you're more on point in that it's the individual whose ability is what we should focus on. Is that person able to tell that story the best? And if so, let's celebrate that person's ability, not...
The gender.
The fact of their gender or race or sexual identification.
Do women tend to have more trouble raising money for their projects than men and asserting their authority with mostly male film crews?
Okay, that's a two-pronged question.
We're going to, believe it or not, even though we have an hour, we're going to run out of time.
I know. I'll go fast. Okay, so historically, there has been difficulties for women in raising funds. That is partially because of what happened after the filmmaking era, when Wall Street came into the big studio system and started taking over, which was very male, very aggressive, and they said, we don't want women in here, and out they went. There was also the history of forming unions, which was also violent, and people saying, get the women out of here. This is very violent. This is not safe. And sort of culturally what was considered acceptable suddenly changed at that point, because it was equitable between men and women. There were equal amounts of women and men making movies as directors, raising funds, going on adventures, telling their stories pre the talkies, right, before the studio and the silent era. Studios came in and silent era ended, right? And then in terms of just touching on quickly about addressing how to address a crew. Also, what happened around that time is a lot of men came back from the war, and around the 30s and 40s, or, you know, coming out of World War II, and or out of you know, other situations of being in the military, and they needed work. And so this system of how to be on a set, you know, there was a lot of work for crews for men at that time. It became sort of ingrained that there was a certain way of addressing men and addressing a crew that became very rigorous and militaristic. And so when women came in who may not have had a military experience, I think there's a tendency for people to think like, well, you're not talking in an aggressive way that commands, quote-unquote, the crew. And but there are some amazing women who are addressing this and saying, like, we're making a movie. we're not fighting a war.
Well, haven't things changed? We're long past World War II. You include interviews with a number of women directors, including Leslie Linker Glatter, who has directed episodes of Mad Men and The West Wing, and Sarah Gavron, who directed the films Brick Lane and Suffragette. What advice did they have for women who want to get into directing?
You know, you do have to have a certain amount of grit and stamina and perseverance. And I think that is something that I certainly go back to, about how much you really have to want it and drive yourself forward to stay in it. Tenacity, I think, is the word that Leslie Linker Glatter uses. And their stories are both very, very different, and I've tried to include as many different pathways so that anyone can see there's not just one way. You don't just become a TV director and then become a studio director. You know, you can do now web series and theater and documentaries and all kinds of alternative forms of storytelling that can be incredibly satisfying to your particular unique voice. But I do think that tenacity, strength, determination, and grit are all really essential to pursuing this particular field. Yeah.
Nora, you mentioned some of the other documentaries in the festival. One you mentioned is In the Name of Your Daughter, mm-hmm. about the problem of female genital mutilation and child marriage in Africa.
Yes.
Is that the kind of issue that filmmakers can really make a difference in by documenting what's going on?
Yes, I strongly believe that cinema is such a powerful tool. And also, let's face it, we spoke about Google and Facebook and all those things. We are always constantly in front of a screen in our lives right now, whether it's your phone screen, it's a tablet, it's your computer, it's the TV. We are constantly looking at images. And cinema has a very strong way to impact people's opinions. It's not so much that, you know, it's to raise awareness. That's the most important thing. There are so many issues and so many social issues and problems that are going on in the world today that a lot of people are completely ignorant of and unawares. But once they know about something, they might do something about it.
Another film along those lines is called Piripcura, about a nomadic tribe in the Mato Grosso region of Brazil. If their habitat's being destroyed, it's being destroyed like so much of the world's rainforest, and the rest of us are totally oblivious to what's going on.
Totally. And this film depicts two last survivors of a language that, if they die, that language is completely eradicated from human civilization. And it's very interesting because the filmmakers find them, or actually re-meet them again, because they had been given a flame, a fire, which was going on since 1998. They kept it alive. And then at some point, the rain comes and then they lose the fire. So they come back outside of the forest to get fire. And that's how they see the filmmakers again. And it's really beautiful because at some point they're putting T-shirts on these men. They're naked completely in the film. They're putting on T-shirts. And suddenly you see them completely ridiculed because that's not how they're supposed to be. They're not. That's not their environment.
Even though that's the original Brazil.
Exactly.
A documentary. You wanted to say something, Katie? Oh.
No, I was just thinking, that's amazing, and I can't wait to see that. And I'm thinking of changing my search engine to DuckDuckGo.
Another documentary is called The Advocates, about the problem of homelessness in California.
Yes,
something
in
that
Angeles.
Also gets swept under the rug, although we discussed that on our show recently. It Will Be Chaos is about the problem of refugees in southern Italy. Mm-hmm. Another film, A Dignified Death, is about legal euthanasia in the Netherlands. Danseur is about the lack of boys in dance classes. So you're all
that
over. That's a wide
such a
range.
That is such a beautiful film. It talks about all these male dancers who are ballet dancers and all the attacks, even physical attacks and abuse they have to go through just because they want to be dancers. And that's why the film is Danseur in the French male gender
You also, we mentioned short films. One of the short films is called Boobs, The War on Women's Breasts. And it makes a case against the widespread use of mammography to detect breast cancer. That has to be rather controversial.
It's a very powerful film. And unfortunately, the title doesn't do it very much justice, because when you call something boobs, suddenly people think and it's a, hey, let's have fun and, you know, happy-go-lucky, or maybe a sex film or something. But in reality, it's very deep in the fact that it shows how the medical profession kind of abuses the women who have breast cancer, and instead of doing certain ways of treatments, go to another way of treatments because that makes more money. So it's very strong comment on the medical profession and women and how we are victimized once again.
Well, many of these films strike me as being educational. Another narrative film is called Doing Money, about sex slavery in Britain, not something that we hear much about.
Totally.
And then there's, in the narrative category, your opening night film is called The Merger from Australia.
It's a hilarious comedy from Australia. It was 2018 audience favorite in Australia, about a football team that isn't doing so well, and this person takes it over and decides, okay, what do I do now to revive this football team? And he engages all these refugees and immigrants who don't know how to speak English. Let's say at one scene he says, how's your English? He goes, my English is okay, but my Australian not so good. And, you know, things like this. And then the rest is all the funny situations that come out of it.
Yeva is set in Armenia. You're from all over the world here. Are there any others before we get back to Matthew and Katie?
There's so many. I don't want to forget anybody. There's Public Figure, for example, which is another take on the social media, but this time it's about influencers, people who influence our lives with thousands and millions of followers, and then all these companies go and insert ads onto their Facebook and YouTube or whatever profiles.
Now, Matthew and Katie, I understand why you'd want your films to be shown in a festival like this, but is this also a way to find distribution? Do film distributors or companies like HBO and PBS come to a festival like this to find creators of new content?
I mean, I'll jump in on that, and I'll promise Matthew I'll leave time for you to talk to. I think that it's twofold. Certainly, one, there's an opportunity to, you know, meet distributors and other people who are interested in spreading the word about the film, but it also just helps the film find the audience that will want to maybe see it later or pass, you know, spread the word about it. And it's the right kind of audience for the film, because it's a thinking audience, an audience that wants to discuss and dive deeper into the topic. And that's one of the things I love about this festival and being a part of it.
If I may jump in terms of distribution, in the past we have done panels on distribution where we have invited distributors and set dialogue between them and the filmmakers whose films we are showcasing, to establish that link between them and direct link. And this year we also have something. We're going to have a one-on-one meetings with a consultant, Jordan Matus, who's going to be on the, he's going to have meetings set up to advise the filmmakers how to package their film, where to distribute them, how to go about it. So all these services are side things that we are providing.
But Matthew, if you want to get the word out, don't we simply go to Google or to Facebook?
Well, you know, it's the irony of this project is that Google has taken to attacking the film and using the very tools that we're talking about to make the film difficult to find.
They're actually attacking your film?
Yeah.
That's crossing the line.
A lot of people were afraid to review it because they're at the mercy of the search engine. And so we are very appreciative to be in a festival like this who's willing to show the film. But, you know, some people, like The Hollywood Reporter, wouldn't touch it. They said, well, you know, because, look, at the end of the day, if Google controls the entire information sector, it's not worth the risk. Or you know, we put up a YouTube and it was taken down immediately of our trailer.
Wow! I hope our festival doesn't get kicked into the fifth page.
No, it should. No, the movie's out, so you should be fine. So.
Yeah. We are on page one right now.
Yeah, right.
So,
this is an example of what we're talking about. I mean, it's exactly what we're talking about. And so, you know, we hope that that the film gets out there and people can become aware and protect themselves going forward.
Yeah, it's all about raising awareness. It's like you said a little while ago, it's very educational. But also we try to make sure that these are films which are entertaining in the first place. Because, yes, there are educational, there are many other places where education about these issues can be found. But we don't want to bore people. We don't want to lecture to them. It's first and foremost cinema, and it has to have that entertainment value.
Well, maybe we shouldn't have used the word educational, but I know. That I always want to learn about things or know about things that are interesting that I don't know about beyond what the president said yesterday, which is pretty much what you get on television. Well, there's so many other things happening in the world, so many really important things.
Actually,
happening
that's
in the world.
One remark we always get back from the viewers, the people who help us view and do the first initial selection, deselection, etc., the yes, no, maybes. And they always thank us. I'm always apprehensive because I say, thank you for your time and so on, because this is all volunteer work. And they go, no, this is fantastic. I learned so much just watching these movies. It's so inspirational, educational, etc. So,
do you, Katie and Matthew, do you also see festivals like this as an opportunity to talk to other filmmakers?
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's the beauty of the independent experience. You know, you get to meet other people who are, you know, living on the edge, living for their film, you know, doing the 24-hour day it's a passion project. You know, we're not raking in the millions here.
And we have two special networking opportunities for the filmmakers. And we have happy hours as well that the local bars and restaurants have chipped in and are hosting us. So we're very happy to do that.
You get the last word, right, Matthew.
No, I'm very excited to meet other filmmakers. I love movies, and I can't wait to see their movies. I can't wait to talk about future projects or hear about their future projects. I think the beauty of documentaries, you get to meet these other people, and sometimes you jump on their projects and collaborate. So I'm pretty excited about all the people we're going to meet and seeing all the movies.
And thank you all so much for participating on my show today. We've been talking about the Socially Relevant Film Festival.
Thank you.
With its founding artistic director, Nora Armani, and two of the filmmakers featured in this year's lineup, Katie McLean, director of Seeing is Believing, Women Direct, and M.A. Taylor, director of The Creepy Line.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks, as I said, to Nora Armani, M.A. Taylor, and Katie McLean, to Barbara Kahn, who produced today's show, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.